I just like to point out that I kind of put a picture of the Hellbender on there to entice everyone to come. There hasn't been Hellbenders historically found in the Hidden River yet, anyways. So, an introduction. This is the Pigeon River watershed. It flows out of Haywood County, North Carolina, into Cott County, Tennessee. And the headwaters actually start around Black Mountain. They flow off of Black Mountain. And the Pigeon actually begins technically here at the West Fork and the East Fork confluence. And they run towards Canton, North Carolina. And then there's a paper mill in Canton, which we'll talk about shortly. And it crosses the North Carolina-Tennessee border into Newport, where it dumps into the French Broad River. The Pigeon River is about 69.5 miles in length, and it's a fifth water stream. And this is the area of Tennessee that it's in. In 1908, Champion International began operation on a paper mill in Canton, North Carolina, where I showed you earlier. They use a chlorine bleaching process, and they dumped all of the toxic byproducts into the Pigeon. And this continued on for many years. And these chemicals included dioxins, furans, and chloroform, which have been known to be toxic to any aquatic life. In 1964, the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission found a certain stretch of the upper portion of the Pigeon so polluted that no fish or mollusk species were present at all. And historically, the Pigeon supported approximately 95 species of native fish and 40 species of mollusks. So that's quite a bit of degradation. The TVA and TDEC and a lot of state agencies use what's called an IBI, which is an Index of Biotic Integrity. And it uses metrics such as native species, darter species, and intolerant fish species, among many others, to assess the health of streams. The Pigeon River, during the pollution time, was receiving IBI scores of 38 or less out of 60. Due to that and the color of the river that all these toxins were causing and the fish kills, a lot of local citizens were really concerned. There was Tennessee agencies and North Carolina agencies that, you know, were kind of realizing that this was a major problem. And the EPA became involved and put pressure on the paper mill to change their process. So they removed the chlorine bleaching equipment and replaced it with a chlorine dioxide and oxygen delignification system, which basically, in essence, eliminated all the toxic chemicals that they had been previously dumping into the Pigeon. The IBI scores have steadily improved ever since, and last year the score was 54 out of 60, which is a great improvement over 38 out of 60. So some justification for my research. Like I said earlier, they do IBIs every year, you know, and that looks at the fish species, and we've done benthic invertebrate surveys, but no one's really looked at the salamander species, which are just as important. Atlas of Amphibians in Tennessee by Redmond and Scott, which is some gentlemen over at Austin Peay, they've documented species in Cott County, but no one's ever actually studied the Pigeon itself. We know dioxins have eliminated all fish species, but we don't know their effects on salamander diversity. And this is important because there may be threatened and endangered salamander species, and we have no idea. So we can't manage for them if we don't know that they're there. So dioxins act as endocrine disruptors and can cause abnormal development, such as unhatched eggs and deformed animals in salamanders and amphibians in general. They're known to accumulate in body fat and resist biological breakdown. So they actually build up over time. The amphibians can't get rid of them. And they're actually passed on from the mother to the eggs as well. So there's not really an out in the system for the dioxins to get out. Aquatic salamanders and the eggs and larvae of terrestrial salamanders are exposed to sediments containing these contaminants, so they have a higher risk of adverse side effects. So kind of the question that I'm looking at, or hope to look at, is has the historical release of dioxins from the Canton paper mill decreased salamander species diversity? We really don't know at this point. So some research objectives. I would like to conduct aquatic surveys of the Pigeon River, the bypass portion of the Pigeon, which is a pristine portion of the Pigeon that hasn't been dammed or hasn't had any kind of toxic chemicals dumped into it, and it doesn't go through the reservoir, and it's spring fed, so it should be fairly clean. And then I'm going to also look at two tributaries in case the salamanders have had to retreat into the tributaries during the time of pollution. I'd also like to conduct terrestrial surveys to identify those species that may be utilizing the pigeon to lay their eggs, or for larval development, because a lot of species, especially the plethodontids, will lay their eggs in the water or stream side, and the larvae will develop and then come onto land. So they may be affected as well. And then also test water quality at each site to accurately compare species composition. Okay, so each stream that I'm going to survey will have 5 aquatic sampling sites, and each of those sites will be at least 100 meters apart. And the sites on the pigeon, because we have the mill situation, I'm going to try to do one right at the mill. It's not really feasible to do one above the mill, or I would do that. Right at the mill, slightly below the mill, and then further down the mill all the way into Tennessee. All sites at each stream will be sampled once per month for 3 months. So we're going to hopefully do May, June, and July of this year. And that's to kind of avoid any adverse effects that, in case we have a drought this year again, the water would be lower in July, August, and September. So we're going to try to get it done as early as possible to avoid that. I'm going to also do a preliminary survey in May to determine which tributaries we'll use. And that's kind of dependent on flow levels. Like I said earlier, you know, if the flow looks low in May, we're not going to be able to use it later on in the summer. And also, if there's suitable habitat, if there's enough large rocks for aquatic salamanders to live in, there's enough a nice riparian zone and all that, and then also ease of access just to get our equipment down there. And possible tributaries for sampling are Jonathan's Creek, which is below the mill. Fines Creek is a really great trout stream. It's kind of high gradient, so that should be good habitat for salamanders. And then Hurricane Creek is a tributary to the bypass portion, the pristine part of the pigeon I was telling you about. So proposed methods for objective one, which was to conduct aquatic surveys. We're going to be doing area-constrained searches, and I've kind of drawn a little picture for you here. This is the river, and we'll be doing basically blocking off a 50-meter section, searching shoreline to shoreline. Everyone will just kind of line up in a line and search the whole 50 meters, turning every rock that a salamander could be hiding under. We'll capture salamanders, place them in mesh bags, and then walk them over to the shore and process them. That's where we'll measure snout vent length, total length, weight, and determine sex and species for each individual. And then we'll return the individuals to location found to minimize their stress and kind of preserve their habitat. We're looking for different size classes because it's important that you have all different size classes. If you only have adults and you don't find any larvae, that's kind of an indicator that the population isn't doing so well. And here's kind of an example of what it looks like when we'd be doing that. So for objective two, we're going to be conducting terrestrial surveys to identify salamander species. And to do that, we're going to be doing belt transects. So here's our river from earlier, if you will. And then there's the 50-meter stretch that we'll be sampling. So we'll have a transect on each side of the 50-meter aquatic transect. And the belt transects we'll be doing are going to be 5 meters by 50 meters. And we're basically going to be searching everything in there again, turning over anything that we can find that looks like salamander habitat. And each one of these transects will be counted as an individual point later on in statistical analysis. So to actually complete the terrestrial surveys, we'll be turning rocks and logs and sorting through leaf litter. We'll capture salamander and place in plastic container to be processed. Measure, again, snout vent length, total length, weight, and determine sex and species. And then, again, return individual to location found to minimize stress and maximize habitat. For objective three, we'll be recording pH, dissolved oxygen, and temperature at each site on each visit. Those are fairly easy to sample. We have the equipment to do that. I would also like to sample, to remove a few salamanders for dioxin testing in their body tissue since they do build up. I found out today that's pretty expensive and hard to do. So unfortunately, that may not happen. If that doesn't work, we can compare the dioxin levels in the water. I think it's measured by TWRA and has been measured for quite a while now. So hopefully we can compare the dioxin levels with the salamanders that we find now to historical levels, hopefully. So what are some species that have historically existed in the Pigeon River watershed? Well, this is the Blue Ridge Two-Line Salamander, and it's I kind of listed them in importance, levels of importance, sort of. This one lays its eggs in the water, but it's a stream-side salamander, but it's not fully aquatic. So it's not quite as important. I mean, it is, but you know what I mean. This is the shovel-nosed salamander, and it is fully aquatic, and it lays its eggs in pretty swift-flowing water, as I understand it. So it's very important. You know, if the water is contaminated, its eggs are affected. If they can't develop, you know, which is a side effect of dioxins, then that species could be wiped out rather quickly. And then this is the mud puppy, which is also fully aquatic and would have the same issue. So what species exist today? We don't know. No one's really looked at specifically at the pigeon, so hopefully we'll find something interesting amidst all of this. So with that, I would like to acknowledge the Department of Forestry, Wildlife, and Fisheries for funding my assistantship in this program, or this proposal. Dr. Wilson, who's my advisor, and Dr. Gray for answering my questions. So with that, I'll take any questions. Yes? So the question is, how quickly would I expect the salamanders to bounce back from the drought? You know, that's something I'm wanting to look at, because I also don't know how the drought would affect the chemical components as well. You know, that's kind of why I want to look at the tribs, because like fish species, they'll hide. Like when the drought comes, they'll find a deep pool and everybody will just hide in it. So I'm thinking that's probably what salamanders will do, you know, find a big rock out in the middle and hide underneath it. So yeah, I'm not really exactly sure, to be honest. Okay, the species that I listed up there, those are based on the Atlas of Amphibians in Tennessee, the book that was put out by Redmond and Scott. They're not specifically in the Pigeon, but they're in Cott County, which was the best I could find, basically. Okay, sure.
You've got the area near the paper mill pit, you know, you can buy it with fresh fruit, so you've got control of the experiment.
Right.
How do you know that your controller is actually a controller? What your inventory ends up with a paper mill, how do you know that that's not just what's at the paper mill anyway?
Okay, so the question is, how do I know that what's at the paper mill is not normally different than what's in the tributaries, my controls? That's a good question. The tributaries that I'm sampling are going to be, there's one that's really close to the mill. I try to get it as close to the mill as possible so that those species would be the most comparable, if you will. And then the one for the bypass portion of the Pigeon, that's the pristine part, try to select that tributary as well, since that's kind of a special case, because that's definitely not going to be the same as the Pigeon, just because it's never been polluted. So that tributary will be more in comparison for the bypass portion than it will be for the Pigeon itself. So I'm kind of selecting two different tributaries, one for the cleaner part and one for the more polluted part, I guess. And I don't really have any way of knowing, you know, historically, all of that's records. You know, some of the records go back to the 30s, some are to the 60s, and some are just kind of random, one salamander here or there. It's kind of a scattered, I'm still working on trying to get all the data together. Okay, so the question is, how far would the terrestrial salamanders typically go from the river in normal life? There's a couple of papers that I kind of went by to design this, and they found, I think the Blue Ridge Two Line, the one that I showed you a picture of that was on the far left, it went as far as 100 meters, but that was during a night survey, which may be something that I may have to incorporate because they do travel farther at night. During the day transects, the farthest that anything they've found was, I think, like 42 meters. And this was an Appalachian study, so that's why I kind of used it to model this a little bit. Yes? Right, so the question is there an agency that monitors dioxin levels in water? As far as I know, I think it's the TWRA. It may be TDEC, but I'm pretty sure TWRA samples every so often for dioxin and has been doing so for a while in the water. I don't know if they sample sediment as well or if it's just water. But I'm trying to contact them right now to find out, since I found out I can't do the tissue samples. So. Yeah, because it's basically the same, pretty much. Right, yeah. Okay, awesome, sure. Okay, thanks. Any other questions?